From Alaska to Florida, California to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, he has guarded popes and presidents. Now Lawrence Cunningham joins us to discuss the many questions surrounding the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Results of the Arizona primary are in, and Carrie Lake has clinched the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate to face off against Democrat Ruben Gallego. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. When it comes to actual policy, both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris appear to have dumped deep thought for off-the-cuff proposals. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And we all depend on GPS in our travels, but has the technology made us a nation of geographic illiterates? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The congressional investigation into the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, is now underway. But questions continue to swirl. To sort through all of that, we turn to Lawrence Cunningham. He is a former career Secret Service agent and an expert security consultant with Essential Security Strategies. Lawrence, welcome to American Radio Journal. Lawrence, I did give our audience a little bit of your background, but it is very extensive relative to the topic we're discussing. You are obviously one of the foremost national experts. So tell us a little bit more about yourself.
My experience in the protection arena, specifically protecting dignitaries, extends back to my beginning career with the Secret Service in 1974. I spent 20 years in that agency, and then in 1994, I retired and went into a private consultancy businesses and endeavors. So the sum and substance of this is we're looking at 50 years of experience, specifically with dealing with threats, and importantly, how these things start and how they sort of manifest themselves, and then some of the aftermath.
As we take a look back now at what happened here with former President Donald Trump, the assassination attempt in Butler. There have now been a number of congressional hearings. There are investigations all over the place. The former head of the Secret Service has resigned. What is the current status of the investigation?
The current status of the investigation is ongoing, but because of conspicuous silence, if you will, by the Secret Service in terms of specifics and also by the FBI, we are kind of in limbo. We're waiting for more specificity. We're waiting for more results of presumably unfettered objective investigations. And I'm glad you brought that up because I'm concerned that because of this silence, other ideas, other potential theories, and in some cases even conspiracy theories seem to get more credence. Because you know how it is, when there's a vacuum of information, there are other people and things that fill that void. And that's a dangerous thing. We want to make sure we get the facts out as they are. And that's my purpose here today. I would like to set the record straight and urge reforms, but we can't do that unless we have objective information. What I'll be commenting on is what I've seen, what my sources have told me, and then blend that through a filter of 50 years of experience, not only in the private sector, but the public sector. And I would note one other thing. In the past 20 years, at any rate, I've been very involved with training responders, emergency responders, emergency management folks, police, fire, and the military on this very topic. How can we get ahead of this? After 9/11, the mandate from the government was we need to be more proactive. We need to be putting a lot more energy into preventive measures. And that doesn't mean siloed. That means as a team. So that's the sum and substance of what I've been doing. I've taught literally 10,000 different folks in those categories I just mentioned.
A lot of us are astounded by the fact that this attempted assassin was so close to the president on a building within line of sight. Talk a little bit about some of the missteps that occurred that allowed this situation to even occur.
I've looked at this carefully because as it happens, I've done about 200 advances, lead advances for the White House and also for other heads of state across the planet. And of course, before I was assigned those roles, I did sites, much like the site you're seeing at Butler and other sites, smaller, larger. Initially, I was giving everyone the benefit of the doubt, but after studying the videos, listening to the commentary, particularly the commentary from the responders in the locale, the public video, and some of my sources, and some of the whistleblower information that Senator Grassley has compiled, I have to conclude that it was basically a flagrant disregard of basic standard operational procedures. Either that, or it's a profound lack of understanding of protective protocols and how they need to be applied. I can't soften that any more than I just explained to you. And I'll tell you why, because there is a very specific schedule, a very specific algorithm that is followed and should be followed when you conduct an advance, whether it's a sitting presidential advance, a major candidate, a foreign dignitary, or even some of the private sector folks that I've assisted and trained, and a number of others that I've been involved with, to do just that. Look at their security plan, their strategy, deduce vulnerabilities, and then offer recommendations to shore up those vulnerabilities. All the discussion and all the readings, and I read most of them, I've listened intently to all the discussion. And I would have to offer right off the bat, conspicuously absent from this discussion is the fact that there is a legal and statutory basis for the Secret Service to conduct protection. Basic Title 18 United States Code 3056 basically addresses the investigative and protective authority and the specific duties the Secret Service has. Now, for candidate nominee protectees, and that would be anyone that's a candidate, a declared candidate, the candidate nominee protection has specific language in that same Title 18 USC 3056, but it's a subset, parenthesis A, parenthesis 7. And in that, it specifically references criteria and protection duties that need to be applied vis-a-vis a presidential protective security advance. Now, I think it's important to mention that you hear a lot of discussion, at least initially, by the former director, the current director, and others, that they abdicated, or shall I say, they assigned the responsibility of protection to that outer perimeter. Candidly, that's simply heresy. Is simply not true. If you look at this statute and look at history, every bit of that is the responsibility of the Secret Service, even though they've defined a perimeter based on geography, logistics, whatever the case may be. That does not absolve their responsibility beyond their arbitrary security perimeter, namely the rooftop of the AGR building. That is clearly within the protective purview and responsibility of the Secret Service. And the attempt to abdicate that is just heresy. It's just not even in the same universe. That I don't know what book they're reading, but that is simply not tenable, period. Just not. And ask anyone that's done this at the level that I have, and there's many others of my colleagues, they would tell you the same thing. This is simply basically passing the buck in a very irresponsible and negligent way. There's just no way you can abdicate that. So I want to get that out there because I can give you a couple of examples very quickly. Let's suppose someone from Pittsburgh is driving down and is arrested by the police for speeding. And on the way, say prior to the rally, they find a gun in the car and they find notes about or maps about Butler rally and maybe even notes, I want to kill him, whatever. Just because that particular arrest took place 40 miles away or 30 miles away does not abdicate the responsibility of the Secret Service to act on it. They can't know everything, but if they have knowledge, they are required. It's not an option. They are required to act quickly. When we were younger agents on the duty in a field office, if there was a threat, even a veiled threat, and you were on the duty and it was 3 a.m., you have to be rolling within 10 minutes. You have to move, and you have to go investigate it. Talk to the police, talk to the person, whatever the case may be. That was required in my era. So to try to abdicate arbitrary security lines where your protective purview begins and ends is just simply false.
We have been talking with Lawrence Cunningham, who is a security consultant with Essential Security Strategies. He was career Secret Service and has been talking to us about the impact of the Trump assassination attempt. And, of course, the investigations will be ongoing. Lawrence, thank you for taking time to be with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the offices of the Club for Growth. We have, over the last few months, been keeping an eye on the state-by-state primaries that have been occurring. This past week, we had primaries in Arizona, and we're going to discuss the results with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Arizona, a battleground state here, Scott. So what happens in Arizona matters to folks all across the country. A big U.S. Senate race. Want to fill us in on the result?
First, I think we wind back and we talk about Kyrsten Sinema just for 1 minute, because here was a woman, sort of a maverick of the Democratic Party in Arizona, trying to fill some of that John McCain vacuum that went away when he passed away. And she ultimately left the Democratic Party, became an independent, and Ruben Gallego announced that he was going to run for the United States Senate as a Democrat there. He ran unopposed in their primary. And earlier this year in March, you had Sinema basically decide, hey, you know what? I'm not going to run as an independent. I'm going to hang it up, and I'm going to totally retire. So it's gone from being a three-person race to now being just a two-person race. And this week, we had the Republican primary. Carrie Lake was the 2022 Republican nominee in Arizona for governor, and she lost that race by less than 1%, just a couple thousand votes among, I think, 2.5 million votes that were cast in 2022. And so Lake ran against Mark Lamb this time, and then another candidate got about 5%. Lamb ended up with 39% of the vote. Lake got 55%. She was strongly supported by Donald Trump and sort of the MAGA America First wing of the Republican Party. Carrie Lake has been just an incredibly strong communicator. I think that she's got the ability to spar with the media in a similar fashion than we sometimes see with Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis, when they're willing to challenge the media's perception or narrative that's getting injected into a story. And so I'm excited about Carrie Lake being the Republican nominee. Ruben Gallego is somebody that has raised a boatload of money. He's raised over $32 million. The interesting thing about that is he does have, I think, about $9 million cash on hand. This is how the Democrats fund their candidates, right? They spend a lot of money to raise a lot of money, and then they end up having a little bit more of a surplus. Right now, Carrie Lake's probably sitting on $2.5 million or so, and she's raised about $10 million. But money matters in these races, and it's important to make sure that our Republican candidates are well-funded. We're excited about Carrie Lake flipping that seat.
There was also a key congressional race in Arizona.
Yeah, you might remember the so-called Vacate 8 included a couple of guys from Arizona. One of them received a primary challenger that was supposed to be backed by the Kevin McCarthy apparatus and sort of political power that surrounds him. And it was a candidate, believe it or not, his name was Jack Smith, and he was running against Eli Crane. Eli Crane is a member of the House Freedom Caucus. He's a Navy SEAL. He has been just a rock-solid conservative fighter, totally representing his district and not falling into anything that the Uniparty is trying to get him to cave on. Eli was endorsed by Club for Growth PAC, and Club for Growth Action supported him in the race. Ultimately, he won with 80% of the vote, sending a clear message to the swamp in Washington, D.C., that you can't take out Eli Crane.
We also have the impact here potentially, as I mentioned at the start, that this was a battleground state here, Scott. U.S. Senator Mark Kelly on the short list as VP potential candidates to run with Kamala Harris at the time of this recording, that no decision has been announced. Any potential impact of his being vice president on all of these races in Arizona?
Well, certainly if he's named the running mate for Kamala Harris, he will be a very, very strong candidate, and he will help them tremendously in Arizona. There's been a rumor this week that Kamala is going to make the announcement next week in, I think, Pennsylvania, and Mark Kelly said next week that he plans to be in Arizona. Now, they could be running one over on us, but obviously Josh Shapiro from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is on the short list, along with Tim Walz in Minnesota and Mark Kelly in Arizona.
Well, Josh Shapiro is a whole other story, which we may talk about in coming weeks. But let's turn now to the state of Missouri. Scott, they're going to be holding primary elections next week. Want to give us an overview of what's up for Missouri?
In Missouri, there's a few big races that I'm keeping my eye on. The first one is the governor's race, where you have Kehoe against Ashcroft and Bill Igel. Bill Igel is the conservative in the race. He's currently running in third place. But recently, President Trump endorsed all three of them. And you might remember that he did a co-endorsement for Eric in 2022 when Eric Greitens ran against Eric Schmidt. I think this is a situation where Trump has a lot of support in Missouri, and he doesn't really want to split that. We're getting later in the campaign with an August primary, but that governor's race is huge. And then when you swing down to the attorney general race, the incumbent Andrew Bailey is faced against Will Scharf. Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action have been supporting Scharf in a big way. We're hopeful that he can pull out that win. That's going to be a really tight race. And then down in the 3rd Congressional District, there's an open seat to replace Blaine Lucemeyer. And Bob Onder is a former state senator. He is just a tremendous conservative, somebody that I personally support as well. Club for Growth PAC has endorsed him, and we're confident that Bob is going to be the next U.S. congressman from the 3rd Congressional District in the Show Me State.
We, of course, will have results from that primary next week. Also, next week, we will know who the Democratic nominee for vice president is. So tune in again next week, folks. It's going to be another interesting show with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and has over 550,000 members from all 50 states. If you want to sign up for free, just visit clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, talk with you next week.
Okay, thank you.
Deep thought and serious discussion are out, and off-the-cuff policy prescriptions are dominating the 2024 presidential campaign. To learn more, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
A few minutes before 10 a.m. on Wednesday morning, former President Donald Trump dropped a proposal that in any other presidential administration would have been a major policy plan that got a huge rollout. Seniors should not pay tax on Social Security. That's what Trump tweeted, or rather posted on his Truth Social account in all caps. Seniors should not pay tax on Social Security. But what was significant about this announcement, I think, is really what wasn't included in it rather than what was. I'll explain. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This proposal from Trump, this one just dropped at 10 a.m. this past Wednesday, would be obviously a hugely expensive policy change. According to one quick estimate by a former White House chief economist, dropping the requirement that taxes are paid on Social Security income would reduce federal revenue by about $1.5 trillion over 10 years, and it would add $1.8 trillion to the national debt, the extra cost there being because there would be interest on the extra borrowing that would be required if that revenue went away. This plan would also accelerate Social Security's slide into insolvency, and obviously, it should go without saying, but this would be a huge tax break for Americans who collect Social Security checks, for older Americans, for retired Americans. It's not a tax break that would be particularly good at fostering economic growth, and it would be a narrowly targeted one rather than the sort of broad-based tax breaks and tax cuts that Republicans have typically supported in the past. Now, despite all of that, the policy machinations here aside, I think the most notable thing about the way this announcement was made was, as I said, what it didn't include. There was no attempt, obviously, to reckon with these figures. There were no surrogates that were dispatched to cable news to explain why this would be a good or necessary proposal. No press releases. There was, of course, no attempt to explain what government programs would be cut to offset that drop in revenue. For that matter, there had been no sense that this idea had been percolating within Republican politics before Trump dropped this proposal on Wednesday. It wasn't mentioned at the Republican National Convention. It didn't come up at all in Trump's speech, and it wasn't included in the party's platform. So like so much else in the Trump era, this looks like an idea that went from the former president's head to his social media account with very few stops in between and probably not a lot of thought put into it. Now, there is something to be said for that degree of I don't know, let's call it transparency. If nothing else, this is quintessentially Trumpian, right? Hastily conceived, maybe not necessarily deeply considered policies, things that are really more marketing slogans than substance. And ultimately, let's just call this what it is, a nakedly political play to win the votes of Social Security collecting Americans. That's what's going on here. Still, I think the more interesting thing here politically is to contrast this with what happened just a day before, when the Trump campaign officially and gleefully sunk the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. That was a 900-page document in which Heritage, the preeminent conservative think tank, had outlined an extensive plan for policies that Trump could pursue in a prospective second term. That project had been headed by a former Trump administration official, Paul Danz, and it was pretty central to everything that Heritage had been doing in the past few years as it had executed a kind of institutional-wide pivot towards populism and towards Trumpism, led prominently by the organization's president, Kevin Roberts. In a statement about Project 2025, two of Trump's top campaign officials didn't merely bury the whole project, but they also issued a threat. They said that this should serve notice to anyone or any group trying to misrepresent their influence with President Trump and his campaign. It will not end well for you. That was a joint statement from Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita at the Trump campaign. The obvious translation there, how dare anyone try to substitute actual policy substance for whatever random thought might pop out of the former president's head on a Wednesday morning. That's the way Trump governs. That's just the way it's been for a while. We're kind of used to it, and there maybe even is some positive to it, but it's just not, there's not going to be much substance there. Meanwhile, on the other side of the coin, Vice President Kamala Harris has launched her campaign by veering hard into what you might call a Trump-like policy nihilism of her own. She's already tried to memory hole her track record as the Biden administration's so-called border czar, and she's had a lot of help from the media in doing that. That's a job that she obviously held, but is now refusing to admit she ever did. And she's also trying to rewrite her positions on a bunch of other stuff, too. For example, Harris was a co-sponsor of the Green New Deal when she was a member of the Senate in 2019, and she voiced her support for that progressive environmental package while campaigning for president that same year, a campaign that obviously didn't go very well for her. Now she's backing away from that. This week, a spokesman for the Harris campaign told the Washington Examiner that Harris no longer supports the federal jobs guarantee. Basically a promise that the federal government would provide family-sustaining jobs to anyone who wanted them. That had been a key feature of the Green New Deal. Harris now doesn't support that. Meanwhile, the Examiner points out that Harris has also backed away from her endorsement of eliminating private health care plans and supporting Medicare for All. She's backed off of that. Her campaign has also recently told The Hill that she will not seek to ban fracking if she is elected, but that stands in direct contrast to comments she made a few years ago while running for president when she said to CNN, quote, "There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking." There now seems to be quite a bit of a question about that. Maybe all of this is Harris embracing her own philosophy of being unburdened by what has been. Maybe she's simply taking a page from Trump's book. I mean, after all, the former president has never paid much of a price for just making it up as he goes along, and she now seems to be doing the same thing. For both Trump and Harris, I think simply telling voters what they think they want to hear is possibly the most direct route to winning an election, but that cynical approach to campaigning sidelines any serious discussion of policy, and it means that the election is likely to be decided on far stupider grounds. We're going to have to put up with a lot of talk about things that really don't matter because neither campaign seems to have much interest in talking about the things that do. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the two dueling presidential campaigns at Reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Our reliance on GPS to travel has made us less knowledgeable about our nation's geography. Dr. Paul Kengor is editor-in-chief of the American Spectator. He relates his own experience on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The GPS and global positioning system ought to stand for geographically pretty stupid. Relying on GPS, even with its indisputable benefits, is making us a nation of geographic illiterates. Of course, not that geography was a strong point for Americans to begin with. We've all heard horror stories of the dismally low percentage of Americans who can find even Texas on a map. Yes, Texas. In my college lectures on China and Taiwan, I cite data on how few Americans can locate either one of those countries, even as our nation, America, has long had a security commitment to Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion. I ask my students, do you think Americans will want to defend Taiwan when they can't even find it on a map? But let's stick to the geographic confines of the United States of America. And to this, well, let me plead guilty. Last month, I drove a rental car from New York City to a small town in New Hampshire. I had no map in the rental car. Our family vehicles actually do have travel atlases. Like a geographically blind idiot, I counted solely on my handheld gizmo. That is, my phone and its Google Maps GPS to get me out of Manhattan, northward onto the Hudson Parkway, and eventually into Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, and ultimately New Hampshire, five states. All along, I had no idea where I was going, or even which state was up next. I found myself pleasantly surprised to be in, voila, behold, Vermont. Once leaving New Hampshire, I was back in Vermont again, temporarily, passing through beautiful rural environs, and then into eastern New York and ultimately across I-90 all the way home to Grove City, Pennsylvania. I was grateful to my gizmo for the scenic cruise and perfect directions. But what would have happened if my phone battery had run out, or if I lost reception, which actually happened in a remote part of New Hampshire for a while? Well, I would have been up a Vermont creek without a paddle. That's what would have happened. Appreciative as I was for the flawless GPS navigation, it was lamentable that I never had a larger map in front of me to forecast where I was going. I was totally reliant on the phone clipped below my radio. It was a feeling of helpless ignorance. You have no large-scale image of what's ahead of you. And if your GPS has that ability, how many users actually use it? By and large, the thing tells you where to turn and when. And you, well, you do as you're told. Not that long ago, after my wife and I were married in May 1993, Susan was my co-pilot and navigator. With a map on her lap, sitting shotgun, she splendidly charted our course with dexterity and accuracy. In fact, this led to many pleasant backroad voyages. In the early 2000s, we drove across the country twice. We really saw the country in ways that people who fly never experience. By the way, that's a big regret of flying. Our kids, in the process, learned the nation's geography. We had no GPS back then. But that said, admittedly, GPS has huge advantages, no question. I must say I'm genuinely amazed by the technology, and truly, I can't imagine life again without it. It has made getting from A to B to Z unbelievably easy. You can avoid traffic jams, learn about rest stops and restaurants and coffee shops ahead, and even pinpoint your ETA. It provides far more pluses than negatives. But alas, GPS is also creating a nation of geographically stupid citizens. And yes, count me among them. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WNTE-FM in Mansfield, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.